everyone. Welcome to the 288th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a device-laden show for you today. We're going to be talking about ransomware devices, Amazon devices, more Amazon devices, a few Google devices. Hey, what Apple's planning on for the smart home based on some patents. We're also going to be getting into some back-end or industrial stuff with a new platform for Twilio, some chips from ARM, Vodafone has a service worth mentioning, and we've got some smart devices from Yale, Swarm, and a pro tip from a fellow podcaster. And we're going to hear from our sponsor, Perceive, talking about boosting privacy with edge-based machine learning. And we're going to hear from our guest this week, Emily Anthes, who is a science journalist and the author of The Great Indoors. She's come on the show to talk to us about the future of sensors in our offices and turning our smart home into a medical device. It's pretty cool. So, all of this and more await you. But first, let's hear from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Ayla Networks. Ayla is a leading provider of edge connectivity, device management, and application enablement for the Internet of Things. They're enabling the world's largest companies to connect any device on any cloud to any application. Ayla has the fastest time to market. They are flexible and future-proof. Plus, using Ayla Networks allows you to increase your operational efficiencies and enhance your customer experience. For more information, please visit www.aylanetworks.com. That's www.aylanetworks.com. Okay, Kevin, let's talk about one of my favorite nightmare scenarios that is actually still kind of a nightmare scenario, but worth mentioning. So I once read a science fiction story, I think it was in Wired, and I think it was by Matt Honan a couple of years ago, about the smart home when it goes horribly wrong. And one of the things was there was a ransomware attack on his coffee maker and his thermostat. So until he paid the ransomware, his thermostat was, it was too hot and he couldn't have coffee. And I thought that was hilarious and also very prescient because a researcher at Avast has found a way. He's just playing with his smart coffee maker made by Smarter. And he discovered that, yes, it can be accessed and it can be controlled remotely for ransomware purposes. So I don't know. You want to talk about this?
This makes me cringe because I've recently said I wanted a smart coffee maker and I don't think I do anymore. And just to be fair, this particular coffee maker is no longer supported by the vendor, if I read this correctly. Not that that excuses anything, but I should say that. I don't want people to panic here. Yeah, so basically the researcher was able to kind of reverse engineer in a sense, like, or figure out how the firmware works on the coffee maker, what commands it needs to send to make a cup of coffee or, you know, heat up the water, et cetera, et cetera. And once he was able to figure that out, he was able to remotely send commands like stop those things from happening. And even went as so far as this particular coffee maker has a display on it that could show a message that says, you know, want coffee, send Bitcoin or whatever. It's kind of scary. And as I got into the details of it, I sort of understood why this particular device had an issue because we've mentioned this before. We've reported several exploits on a particular wireless chip and module from, well, the ESP8266. And I don't know if that's the one that still uses Telnet or whatever, but regardless, it's had issues in the past with security. And that's what this coffee maker uses. So, yeah.
This is the Espresso Wi-Fi board that pretty much everybody uses. It's the 8266.
Not the Espresso.
What? Espressif.
Right, not the Espresso, I said.
Oh, coffee jokes. I should have more coffee. Oh.
Sorry.
I'm horrible co-hosts. You're lobbing these and I am failing to catch them. All right. Yes, this board and the accompanying ESP or SP32 board both had some flaws. It was not updatable. So the idea here is if you have this particular board, you should just, I guess, discontinue that product. I don't really know. We'll talk about that actually later on in the show. So we just wanted to share this with you because not that we want you to freak out about your coffee machine. Although if you have one of these smarter coffee machines, maybe check the link and see if you want to keep it connected. Maybe you do. Maybe, you know, depending on the ransomware, if it's asking me for a full Bitcoin, I might be like, yeah, I'm going to buy a new coffee machine and I'm going to be...
This actually begs a question that I have a feeling most people would say, no, I don't do this, but I'm going to ask you if you do this. When you buy a device, do you look at the spec sheet beforehand and look and see potentially what modules, what parts, hardware-wise, are actually being used?
No, because most of them don't even print that.
You can still find it, but yes.
I'm not going to. I am already looking for so many things. I'm looking for, you know, bug bounty programs. I'm researching. I mean, before I buy anything, I do research to see if there's like an exploit, active right. exploit against it, which I feel is way more work than I should be doing as a consumer about to buy an expensive device, but I will do it.
Okay. I don't do it either, but I bet you there's a few people that will actually go out to the FCC database and take a look at a product's actual pieces of hardware inside. Very few people, but we shouldn't have to do that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I'm mad about that. Okay. Let's talk about some things I'm not mad about, but some of y'all are a little concerned. We record the shows on Wednesdays, and so last week, we did not tell you about all of the Amazon device news, but we're going to do a quick rundown. I'm going to assume that y'all have seen most of this, but there's a couple things that we thought were worth mentioning. Everyone talked about the Amazon drone.
Ring drone.
It's the Ring drone. It is the, what is it called? It is the...
The Ring Always Home Cam.
Yes, it's always home. It basically is a Ring doorbell attached to a tiny drone that sits in what, Kevin, you said it was like the size of an ice bucket.
It looks like an ice bucket, yeah.
We did a poll, and it's still ongoing, although it won't be by the time you hear this. But I asked earlier this week, would people buy the Amazon Ring drone camera for $249.99, which is what it costs? And 12% of you said yes, and the rest of you said no, with variations on why didn't you add hell no to this? And this is out of 475 votes. Now, obviously, if you're listening to us, you probably are aware of all the questions we raise about privacy in the smart home. So this feels like a self-selecting audience in some cases, but I did think it was interesting that y'all were like, not going
to
buy it.
To be fair, this drone will only record when it's in flight. So when it's sitting in its little ice bucket charger, it does not record anything, no audio, no video. And Amazon says, hey, when it's flying around, you can hear it. It does make a sound. So it gives you a heads up, at least, to know that you may briefly appear on camera. I don't think that totally resolves the privacy issues, but I'll give them credit for that.
And I think a lot of people don't understand the use case, and I'm with them. I think the use cases here are pretty limited. Like somebody pointed out that they have a second vacation home, and they're like, yes, I would like this to fly around my vacation home when I'm not there to check for like water leaks. And I'm like, great use case. And it does offer a lot more flexibility than the typical stayed camera. And maybe people would buy it for checking on their pets. I'm trying to think. My pet would freak out, though, if there was a drone flying around the house. So I don't.
So, well, the drones often make ultrasonic frequency sounds that animals do not like. But that's a whole other separate issue. I am curious, and we don't know all the details here, but I am curious if I can have it be activated when I'm in away mode, when everybody is out of the house. Then it's a little more palpable to me.
Yay.
But not to Stacey.
It only runs when you tell it to run or a disturbance has happened.
Are you sure?
Or a disturbance has happened. It doesn't just like fly around your house all the time because it would lose battery power.
No. It does it on regular intervals or maybe irregular intervals. Yes.
Ah, okay. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Okay, now we have a question to ask. Okay, but that's enough on the drone because Amazon announced some real products that we should probably cover. Briefly, they updated the whole new Echo line. So now we have a new form factor for Echoes. It's a tiny sphere. The Echo Dot is going to be $50, $49.99 for the tiny version. And then the big normal Echo version with a Zigbee radio inside and a sidewalk radio. We'll talk about that in a second. That is going to be $99.99. And then there's also an Echo Dot with clock that is $59.99. So all of those are out there. Plus, they added a new Echo Show. And this Echo Show is actually really cool. It kind of takes a page from, I'm going to say it, Facebook's portal. Yep. It is on a mount that lets it, I'm doing the gesture with my hand and you can't see it, but it moves, it follows you, which is great because I often am using my Echo Show in the kitchen and I'm kind of like moving in and out of the frame and my mom is like, Stacey, stop moving. Why do you call me when you're doing this? She doesn't actually talk like that, but
she says that.
But she does say that. So the Echo Show 10, which is where we are now, is $249.99.
Just wanted to add one security feature that it has, which I think is good. But again, privacy questions for people to decide on. If you have the Alexa Guard service in away mode, the Show 10 will periodically pan around the room and will be able to send you alerts if it sees somebody in the house when everybody is technically away.
That is true. And you said her name. Bad, Kevin.
Did I? I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Madam AG. Madam A Guard. Oops. Sorry, everybody.
They also announced Guard Plus, which is a paid service that does a couple of things. And they also can call a dispatcher that can dispatch emergency response services for you. They also added more noises that Echo could listen to, including the sound of a baby crying, which I did anticipate this when they were like, glass break. I'm like, how soon till Amazon can listen to your appliances and diagnose issues with your appliances? That's not happening yet, but I feel like it's coming. Okay. They also, in the services category, because it's always worthwhile noting how Amazon is going to make more money. In the services category, they do the Guard Plus. They also said that they were going to introduce Care Hub. And Care Hub is a way for you to link your account to somebody else's Echo devices, and you will see when those people interact with their Echo devices. The idea being that you would link it to like maybe an elderly parent, and you don't want to like stalk them throughout their day, but you do want to see that they've gotten up and turned on some lights. I don't think my mom would really go for this, but I do think it would be kind of, there's a lot of offerings out in the market that try to say things like, hey, your parents have gotten up for the day. They're still alive, which is comforting for people.
There's definitely a market for this. It's not for me, but there's a segment of the population that could use this. Absolutely.
And then finally, they launched a bunch of stuff, Ring for the car, three car services, including an always-on camera or a camera that you can have be on and detecting things. They launched a Ring Connect API for cars to integrate with some Ring cameras. And then they also talked about a mailbox sensor. Actually, they didn't talk about it, but they put it out there. And this, again, is using Amazon's Sidewalk network. And this is a sensor that's $30. So everybody who's asking us how to get their mail, and we told you, yeah, buy a $250 Helium router and build your own LoRaWAN sensor. We now have a really good option for you, which is the Ring mailbox sensor for $29.99. And that will tie into the Sidewalk network. So let's talk about Sidewalk. I have begged Amazon to get someone to come on the podcast to talk about Sidewalk. We will see if it happens. But Sidewalk is Amazon's low power wide area network that they announced last September. So in 2019, they were building it into Ring security devices. They're using sub gigahertz. I think it's 915 megahertz band. And they are working with Nordic, Semtech, and Silicon Labs to develop chips that will allow you to send small amounts of data over roughly a mile. And this is awesome. And it's also a little, there's so many questions I have about this because it feels proprietary. Amazon says they've been working very hard on security, and I have no doubt that they are. So what's happening here is this is going to be Amazon's powered network. They've already got a deal with Tile. We talked about that last week. Tile trackers are going to work on this network. So you'll be able to track things even when you're like, even if nobody in your neighborhood has a Tile. So for example, probably 4 years ago, I bought a Tile, I stuck it on my dog's collar, and then I begged my neighbors to install the Tile app. So if my dog got loose, I could track it, right? In this case, if my neighbors had an Amazon device in their house, it would actually automatically connect to those devices using the Sidewalk radios that are in them.
That's the key. Amazon isn't providing the backhaul for this network. It's providing the coverage outside of the home for all the sensor data. You as a consumer with your Amazon devices, and I think all of the new actual Amazon Echo devices, as well as the new Eero routers, are Sidewalk bridges, and you're providing the backhaul to get that sensor data up to the internet.
Yes. So that is what Amazon's Sidewalk network is, and it will compete with other low-power wide area networks like NB-IoT or LoRa or
Cat-M.
Yeah, less Cat-M. Cat-M has pretty robust data bandwidth. Okay, that's a lot about Amazon's devices. We already talked way too long. So let's talk about this week's Amazon news because it can never stop. It announced Amazon One. Kevin, you want to tell us about this?
I almost don't want to because I think it's going to freak people out. But Amazon One is Amazon's new service that is limited to just one or two Amazon stores right now. Actually, Stacey, in your backyard, basically. And you are going to pay for purchases, if you use Amazon One, by scanning your palm over a palm reader. Now, to register your palm, you actually have to go to a store equipped with these readers first. You insert your credit card in the reader, then you have it read your palm, and that ties your identity to your credit card for purchases. The goal here is that Amazon will hopefully roll this out, they hope so, to many, many stores, probably not, working with retail partners and such, working with stadiums and other venues. I don't know if I want to do this, and I'm pretty open about this stuff, and I get the feeling that you're probably squirming a little bit too.
I am. I mean, having shopped at Amazon Go store, there is a 20-second delay where I pull out my phone, I open the app, and I scan it, right, when I enter into the store, because that's how it tracks me. But I don't know if I want to give up basically like the ability to like ever get my palm back from Amazon just for those 20 seconds.
Yeah, this is like easy pass for humans. Again, there will be a small segment of the population will be like, hey, this is great. But I'd rather use an NFC chip or even chip embedded in my hand that I can remove, because it adds that layer, one more layer or barrier to the vendor having my data. I'd rather be tied to some device, some chip. You know?
Tokens are good for a reason, and having an irrevocable access to you as a person. Although I would say take this feeling and channel that to facial recognition, and suddenly we're already there.
Yep.
So
it's almost like a trend that's being very hard to fight against at this point.
It is, but we should keep trying. Okay, let's move away from our dystopian future into more devices. Yay! Google had an event Wednesday afternoon, and Kevin's here to tell you what he saw and what he thinks of it. All those new Google devices.
So yes, Google had its launch night in event. I will be honest, there were three products that were launched. I am a little underwhelmed because there wasn't too much for the smart home, but let's go through them anyway. First was the new Chromecast with Google TV. This comes with a remote. It's $49.99. The remote has a dedicated button for YouTube and for Netflix, as well as a Google Assistant button, which is awesome. They made it a point to say, yes, it does work with your Nest cameras. No other cameras, which I would expect that until hopefully something happens with Chip. Then they had the Nest Audio, which is their upgraded speaker. We kind of knew this was coming, $99. Larger woofer, more powerful tweeter. They said like 50% more bass, 75% more volume. No additional features that the other Nest Audio products have. And then the Pixel 4a with 5G and the Pixel 5 with 5G. And the coolest thing about those phones, I think, is the new Google Assistant feature that's going to come to other Pixels. And that is a way for the Google Assistant, when you're on hold on a phone call, you can basically have the Google Assistant listen for when the hold time is over. And then it will tell you, hey, this call is ready again, and you can start speaking.
Yeah, I would update my phone just for that. But I won't have to, because it sounds like they're sending it to other Pixels. So, yay. I am in the market for a better-sounding smart speaker. My gut says I was going to go for the Amazon Echo Studio, which they launched last year. But I was waiting to see with the results of this announcement. I don't think this really compares. Do you think like buying two of these might be a way to get better audio? I just don't know.
I mean, without testing them, just going on what we were told at the event, yeah, I think so. You know, you do have the same whole home audio system setup that we've had before with the prior speakers and whatnot. But if you're just looking for better sound and a device that looks more like a pillow on its side, then yes, I would go for this.
Yes, that's what I'm always looking for, a device with a pillow on its side. All right, well, thanks, Kevin. And I expect a review unit on the new speakers, so I'm really excited about that, but that is coming, so we'll see. Okay, patents. We don't usually talk about patents because patents are a little, they're just like wishful thinking that you put, that if you have money, you send a document to the government. But Patently Apple, they follow this. They used a couple Apple patents to talk about Apple's vision for the smart home. And I always pay attention because I do think Apple does an amazing job with picturing where they want the world to go and developing devices for that. So in this case, we had actually talked about roughly a year ago, Apple did create this wall unit that sits in like a lighting thing or a power outlet, and it helps track people and give a smart home context. So in the patent filing from this year, so September of this year, Apple's patent focuses more on the smart home as opposed to just generic tools within a building. And it talks about using, the article dubs, virtual tripwires that basically lets you count how many users are passing through a space and differentiating those users possibly based on their biometrics. Mm-hmm. So this is a way to say not only there are two people in this room, but there are two people in this room, and they are Stacy and Kevin. It talks about using heart rate, for example, as a biometric that probably could also use gait detection. And the idea here is when people are in a room, knowing how many people in a room helps you figure out preferences. Like if there's just Stacy, use her preferences. If it's Stacy and Kevin, I don't know. Is there a situation for that? No, not Kevin's. Depends on what Kevin's are, or go default to, you know, generic. So I just wanted to point that out. I like the idea of building this into a building and having this become part of the infrastructure. I will say that as part of the Connected Home over IP group, Project Connected Home over IP, Stuart Cheshire, who is an engineer over at Apple, he talks about using chip as a way to get people to comfortable, like home builders and building operators comfortable with embedding smarts into the walls. And so you could see where Apple is like, all right, we do need a standard so it's not Apple only tripwires, right? Which would be horrifying because I don't want to carry an iPhone. Okay, enough about that. Let's talk about some enterprise news. Twilio on Wednesday, they are holding their Signal big event conference. And Twilio, for those of y'all who are not familiar, is a platform that provides connectivity. So for years, you could go to Twilio and get access to phone numbers, text messaging, anything that requires, you know, phone service. And we used to use Twilio for our IoT podcast hotline, but we switched over. So Twilio has announced an IoT platform that, frankly, sounds very compelling. What they've done is earlier this year, they bought a company called Electric Imp. Electric Imp provided Wi-Fi and 3G modules that had a connection back to a cloud and were always updatable and secure. So you would buy this Electric Imp module, you would install it in your device, and basically from then on out, as long as you kept paying Electric Imp, you had security updates. It would handle all of that for you. This is really compelling. It was also kind of expensive. Some companies were like, I have no users, but I still have to pay Electric Imp for all five of them. So there is the downside there. What Twilio has done, though, they've taken the security side from Electric Imp and combined it with Twilio's very developer-centric, disaggregated kind of connectivity model. So what you've got is an IoT platform that lets you ensure security throughout the device's lifetime. It lets you continuously update and deploy new operating system security updates to the device. And it lets you not worry about all the connectivity layers. Twilio's now handled all of that with the billing, the device management, all of that Twilio does. And you as a developer only have to write your code that you want to make this run. And everything else, Twilio handles everything at the lower levels, including sending that data to a cloud of your choice. So to buy this Twilio module, you will pay a one-time fee that gives you 10 years of access to security updates and data for the device. And there are going to be different plans there, but that's the idea. So this is awesome, because one of the big problems for device manufacturers is they build a device and they're paying an uncertain amount each month in cloud costs associated with it. You're still going to have your cloud costs, but your connectivity and underlying telemetry cloud related costs are now wrapped up in this fee. So
there needs to be more long-term plans and deals like this to remove that type of uncertainty, because that type of uncertainty has definitely hurt some device makers, without a doubt. I mean, some of them, I wouldn't be surprised, aren't even around anymore, partially because of that. And I have to say, if you've never used Twilio and you can code even just a little bit, you can make some amazing things. Everything is very modular. There's tons of quick starts. Their APIs are very easy to use. They support multiple programming languages. And I would say if you're remotely interested in adding connectivity to something, or just, you know, creating a voicemail server on a Raspberry Pi, which is what we did 3-4 years ago, and we used Twilio, it's really actually very easy. It really is.
Yeah. All right. Update on ARM. This week, ARM announced a line of new chips, two graphics processors and one hardcore CPU. These are part of its AE line. And ARM 2 years ago announced the AE line for automotive. And in automotive, the focus on this line was safety. So basically ensuring it met certain standards, certain ISO and SIL standards. And so after they released the automotive enhanced line of chips, they heard from customers that, well, we would like this too. And these were customers in the industrial space. So the idea behind them is they've designed these processor cores to double check their work continuously. And there's different ways it can check its work. So there's different variations on that that the silicon provider will turn on or off for the customer for them. There is a performance hit when you have if you have a cluster of CPUs checking work, there is a performance hit because each CPU, for example, might have the other CPU checking its work. But they've managed to find a way to slightly mitigate that performance hit in the name of safety. So these are designs for silicon that we're going to see probably deployed in the next 5 years or so, because these are really long-term customers. Like automotive people, they might design something in to a part, but then that part, you know, gets designed into a larger part, which is a car. And so you're not going to see this sort of thing for 5 years. But it is very exciting. And the big takeaway I took from this was that autonomy is its own workload with its own special needs. And we're going to need to see chips designed for that. We're probably also going to need software that's going to be focused on that with more backup. So I look forward to this because it's kind of a fun trend to keep an eye on. All right, we promised we'd talk about Vodafone. They've unveiled a recall system that lets IoT customers that use their modules inside their products, like a washing machine or a refrigerator or whatever you might want to stick a Vodafone SIM card in.
A coffee maker.
And what happens is Vodafone can now update. You call Vodafone or you go into your dashboard and you say, hey, the following models have been recalled. And customers using the Vodafone SIM can actually update the device. So send the device like a flashing light. So it's like boop, boop. And the user can then say, why is my device flashing? And then they'll be like, oh, it's because it's been recalled. But it can even auto shut off the device if it presents a danger. So if this is like your gas meter will explode, Vodafone will shut it off. This is obviously a little disconcerting. Like, I don't like the idea of if my gas meter is about to explode, I do want it shut off. That's a good use case. But I can also see somebody using it for DRM purposes. Oh no, somebody has stuck a non-DRM filter in this fridge. Shut it down. And that's where I worry that something like this would happen. I don't think Vodafone is, pushing that right now, but it's possible.
Or if the system gets hacked, you could have everybody's heat shut off in the wintertime. That would not be good.
Yeah. All right. We have connected doorbells that tell us when we have packages on the porch. But as we have all seen from the package thief videos posted, that doesn't always deter people. So Yale, the company that makes locks, has introduced the smart delivery box. And this is an expensive product, but it's also kind of useful for some people, I'm sure. So this is a big old, it's about cooler shaped. So think about a big igloo or a Yeti cooler. This device sits at your door and it's unlocked up until a delivery person comes, drops a package in, and then they lock it. And you'll get a notification on your app. If you want to and you're expecting more packages, you can unlock it for the next delivery person. You can also give a code if you have the same regular delivery person and they will stick packages into it and unlock it.
Right. The keypad, though, is extra. You have to add another $50 to add the keypad to it. So right now, the Yale Smart Delivery Box with Wi-Fi comes in two sizes. The smaller version is $229.99, and the larger one is $279.99, which, if you get a lot of packages, might be worth it.
Actually, yeah, we get a lot of packages.
I think you should get one.
Okay, maybe I'll practice with this. So I actually have the Eufy Smart Doorbell, but we never use it. So I'm kind of with something like this, that actually solves my connected doorbell needs probably better, in all honesty, especially since I'm not traveling. Because I used to like looking at the doorbell camera when my family left the house each day when I was on business trips. It was kind of nice. But no one leaves the house anymore. So
yeah, it's a different time right now.
So anyway, check this out if you're into it. And final little bit of news, we have one of the satellite IoT providers. This is Swarm. They have priced out their module, and it's not cheap. So Swarm has 12 satellites out in the air, but eventually they want to have more for always available coverage. They actually now have a $119 board that you can use to give swarm connectivity to new devices. This is pretty expensive. This is not something that you're going to see on a consumer level device, but it could be something on like a $800 gateway to track your sheep herd in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. Or tracking things, again, in the middle of nowhere. And I don't know what to say about this other than it's kind of pricey. It's pricier than I thought it would be.
Yeah, you don't get a lot of data either. They're going to give you 750 packets per month, and each packet is only 200 bytes, which is really not a lot.
This would basically be for like temperature monitoring, maybe seismic monitoring. Well, no, it wouldn't be seismic monitoring because that's a continuous wave. It would be like...
Even with temperature, it would only be occasionally. You couldn't do it even like every hour because, well, maybe you could fit every hour in a month under 750 packets.
Hard to say. It's expensive. But if it does well, we shall see those prices come down. So, all right. Now it is time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline. This is the segment of the show where we hear from y'all and answer your questions. The IoT podcast hotline is brought to you by Schlage. The best home automation adds convenience, not hassle. And with its built-in Wi-Fi, the Schlage encodes smart Wi-Fi deadbolt shows you just how easy secure can be. Learn more at schlage.com. And we, this month, gave away a Schlage lock. And we will have a new prize for the month of October, but I currently haven't decided what that prize is. So if you want to be enrolled for the mystery prize, give us a call with your question at 512-623-7424, and we will pop you in for the winnings of something that is not a Schlage lock. So that's a little awkward, but we'll get there. And we also want to name this month's winner. We don't have a name for this month's winner.
People don't leave their names all the time. I do not understand.
I always think it's kind of cute because everybody, when they call in, a lot of them say, like, this is Bob from Portland or this is Steve from Indianapolis. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of like the old school radio call-in shows.
I put pins on the map from all our callers. I mean,
that is not true. All right. So we've got no name from who knows where, and he is the winner, but we will let that person know. And they will win the Schlage lock for the month of September. Instead of taking a question this week, we decided we got this awesome tip from Podfeet, which is a podcast about all kinds of tech services done by a woman named Allison. And she sent in an amazing tip that we have to share with you. Kevin?
Yeah, we get this question. It's probably in our top five questions in terms of what people ask us over and over and over again. And this revolves around getting IoT smart home devices connected to a mesh network. The challenge is because the mesh networks don't have two separate network names or SSIDs for a 2.4 gigahertz and a 5 gigahertz network. The 2.4 gigahertz devices sometimes don't always connect to a mesh network. However, thanks to the Podfeet podcast, we have a solution, a very cool solution, if you have an Eero router. And that is, if you go into the settings of your Eero app, click the troubleshooting button, and then select My Device Won't Connect, you will be greeted with a temporarily pause 5 gigahertz network button, which will let you connect those devices that don't want to connect. This is awesome. I would love to see every mesh network provider provide this in their software.
And just so you know, when you click that button, because I have Eero and I click the button, it will pause it for 10 minutes. So there's a little countdown timer that lets you do this. So once you pause it, you don't actually have to come back and unpause it, which is also, I thought, just one of those nice things, you know? Good user experience. So, okay. So that concludes this portion of the show. And please stay tuned for our guest, Emily Anthus, who is the author of The Great Indoors, who is going to be talking to us about sensors deployed in office buildings and turning the smart home into a medical device. Hey, everyone. We are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Perceive, and we're going to learn about Perceive's Ergo chip, which promises increased security, privacy, and speed because it runs at the edge. I've got Steve Teig here, the CEO at Perceive. So Steve, we have long used cloud computing for our connected devices in the consumer realm. What made Perceive want to switch to the edge with its inference processor, Ergo?
Well, the cloud provides the accuracy that consumers are looking for, but is in every other way expensive. It's expensive to use the cloud. It's expensive in energy to send data to the cloud. And there's, of course, the violation of privacy and security. So we set ourselves the challenge of trying to provide the accuracy that people are looking for from the cloud, but in the context of an edge device that would provide very low power and much higher privacy and security.
So how does Ergo attempt to solve the privacy problem?
Well, first and foremost, by not having any of your data leave our chip. So we don't even use an external memory. All of the processing is done in our little 7x7mm chip. And yet we can provide the horsepower that you usually just get from the data center. So as a result, we provide the accuracy that the cloud provides while providing the privacy that you can get only from an edge device.
Okay. And why aren't more product managers looking at the edge?
I think product managers are looking at the edge. They just haven't had a technical solution to make it possible before now. I think product managers have been forced to use the cloud to get accuracy, and we can eliminate that compromise by providing the accuracy they wanted from the cloud in the context of the edge device they really want to have that is running at lower power and preserves the user's privacy.
What kind of applications could better edge inference unlock for consumer devices?
Wow, it's a pretty wide spectrum. The most obvious would be security cameras, making it possible for your home security camera or doorbell camera to recognize who's on the porch, to recognize sounds like someone is breaking a window, to tell that cars are driving by or that animals are in the front of your house. But more broadly, we can have your mobile phone be always on, always watching, always listening without the creepiness of sending data off to the cloud. And we can make every object you interact with smarter about its context to have it do the right thing because it understands what's going on around it.
Okay. I could use more understanding in my devices. So for listeners who are interested in learning more about Ergo, where should they go?
Well, a good place to start is our website at perceive.io.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Emily Anthes, who is the author of The Great Indoors and a science journalist. Hi, Emily. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Man, I am excited. I very rarely have fellow journalists on the program, and I was like a science journalist at that. So super excited. We're going to be talking about a book that came out in June that you wrote. It is called The Great Indoors, and there is a lot in this book, but the most interesting parts for our listeners are going to be about sensors. So there were two really kind of fun chapters. One was what happens with sensors and tracking productivity and wellness in the office. And then the other was turning kind of the smart home into a medical device. So given where we are in the world, I thought we'd talk about the home first. But before that, why did you write this book?
Yeah, that's a good and fair question. You know, one of the things I say very early in the book is that I am an indoorsy person. I was an indoor kid and I've grown into an indoor adult. I like to hang out in my apartment and read and stay inside. But because I'm also a science journalist, I also keep my eye on the literature and I read a lot of journals. And about a decade ago, I just started noticing an increasing number of studies coming out that were sort of these multidisciplinary partnerships between biologists and architects or neuroscientists and interior designers. And I just got really interested in all the ways that our buildings and homes and these spaces we spend so much time in affect us and in ways that we don't really think about or appreciate. So that was the initial spark.
I like it. As a fellow indoor person, I am all about understanding my space and how it influences me. Because we're the IoT podcast, I want to focus in on the smart home, which I thought you did a really interesting thing in focusing primarily on how it's turning into a medical device. So would you like to explain kind of what you discovered and why you went that route?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was partly because of my background sort of as a science journalist, and especially my area of coverage tends to be health and medicine. So that's always what I'm sort of most interested in. But I did notice the beginning of what I thought was a shift. So a lot of the existing smart home products and early smart home products were essentially sort of products for convenience. So, you know, to make it easier to keep the temperature set right in your home or to adjust the lighting or to, you know, monitor your deliveries. And that's all well and good, but I was noticing an increasing embrace of sort of more, I guess, potentially significant and also maybe potentially disturbing applications. And so ways in which, in some cases, these same products were being turned to health monitoring. So we had things like smart mattresses, which part of what they do is maybe adjust to your sleeping position and make things more comfortable, but they are also now tracking your restlessness and your sleep and getting into some of that biological and health tracking. And so I got interested in sort of what that means and what it portends for us that our homes can now increasingly detect, you know, aspects of our physical and psychological states.
Yeah. So I figure just to bring it home to people, you had an example of a senior, I don't know if it was a senior living facility exactly, but a place called Tiger Place. It was tied to the University of Michigan. Can you talk about what they're doing there with sensors and helping people age in place?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, once I decided that I wanted to really focus in on the health applications of smart homes, I started looking for places where maybe this was already happening, where it wasn't just some like pie in the sky future idea that was being patented, but like what were the applications that were happening now? And maybe it shouldn't have surprised me, but it initially surprised me that the place where a lot of this research was really coming together was in the senior care community. And I found one facility in particular, though I think there are some others that aren't super dissimilar. It's an independent living facility. It's designed to help seniors age in place. So, you know, as their needs change, they can bring in different services, provide more care or less care as their health conditions wax and wane. But as it was being built and designed, the nurses that run it and came up with the idea started wondering, well, hey, like we know falls are a big problem for seniors. What if we had some automated way to detect falls in these apartments? So that was the origins of sort of their smart home approach. And they ended up coming up with this system that relies on depth sensing cameras. And essentially what it does is it can extract the silhouettes of residents as they're moving around their homes. And if it detects that the silhouette moves in a way that indicates a fall, it can alert the nurses on staff at the facility. And it even sends them a little video clip of the silhouette so they can look and see, like, hey, is this a real fall or is this a false alarm? But then when that proved to be relatively successful, they started thinking about, like, well, how can we take this to the next step? And ideally, we don't want to be just, like, responding to falls. We want to prevent them and be more proactive. So they dug into the research and they found that there are subtle signs in people's gaits that indicate they might be at high risk of falling. So they wrote software to incorporate into these same fall detecting cameras that now monitor people's gaits. And if somebody's fall risk has risen to 85% or higher, the nurses get an alert in that scenario as well. And then they came up with other kinds of sensors and systems. So there are sensors in the bed that can detect restlessness. There are motion sensors, so you can tell sort of like how many times someone is going in and out of the bathroom or in and out of the apartment. And they can sort of look at all this data holistically and try and get a sense of like, is somebody's health suddenly declining? And then they can respond or proactively intervene.
Yes. And that gets into one of, I think it's the most interesting part, actually, in that segment, which was some of these tools. I know one of the researchers on this project installed some of the tools at her parents' house without the nurses available and discovered that it actually, this data was not particularly useful without a trained person to either understand what was actually happening with the restlessness data or the gait data, or just the ability to know how to fix it. I thought that was really interesting. And I didn't know if you had thoughts about how we should be thinking of and using this type of technology going forward. I just don't think it's going to be super automated, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's my feeling too. And that's something that, you know, the researchers and the nurses themselves like really took pains to emphasize was that, you know, sometimes clinicians from other senior homes come visit and they want to do the same thing. And they really want these systems that are essentially plug and play. You install them and that's it. But really, I think the way these tools should be used and sort of the way they need to be used, given some of the limitations of technologies, as tools. You know, they're not replacements for nurses or for loved ones or for having social connections. They're just sort of another source of data that people can use to sort of make more informed choices about what might be going on with this person, or maybe a, you know, flag that can be raised that, you know, they need to have a checkup. So it's not something that I think will or should replace physicians and nurses. It's just another tool, another source of data they can integrate into all the other things they're doing.
So given that we are going to have some sort of elder care crisis in this country, just demographically, does this help reduce the number of staff? Because that's a lot of times how we think about it. We're like, there are too many elderly people, not enough caregivers. Or should we be looking at different metrics? Like how should we integrate these tools into the way we think about offering care?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know what the effect will be on staff numbers. I would worry about this being used as a rationale for cutting staff, though that wouldn't shock me. What these researchers use as sort of one of their metrics is the number of years that someone can stay in their independent home. And there is some research that suggests that the people that live at this residence, which is known as Tiger Place, are able to stay in their apartments living independently longer when they have the sensors installed than other residents who don't have them installed. So that is one potential sign of success, that sort of this is a tool that can help seniors stay in their homes safely for longer. But there are other metrics too, and I think sort of the long-term implications are still a bit unknown.
Okay, and before we talk about surveillance, because that's a key element here. A lot of the people didn't want sensors in certain places, or, you know, there was an education curve that needed to happen. Let's talk about smart buildings and specifically smart places of employment, because both of them seem to have this overarching issue of surveillance. So in smart offices, you looked at services like Comfy, and you also looked at some of the research that places like WeWork were doing in terms of like how many people were in conference rooms, what times of day did they hang out there, that sort of thing. And after you did this research, what was your conclusion about sensors and the office place?
Well, I guess there are a couple of conclusions. I mean, one is that sensors are here already and they are only going to become more common. I think that will be especially true. Now we're seeing with pandemic response, all sorts of additional sensors being considered and location tracking for contact tracing for employees and things like that. But this is definitely the horse is out of the barn. Sensors are here and coming. And then, I mean, I guess the other big takeaway is that the tools themselves, I think, are kind of neutral, but there's a lot of variation in how they're used and applied, and that matters a lot in terms of, you know, how ethical these systems are, whether they're abusive, whether they're helpful, who they're for, what you're optimizing for. I mean, those are all value judgments. And so there's the technology itself, but then there's all the issues around how it's being used and employed. And those are sort of two different issues.
True. All right. So we've got this idea. Once again, technology is a tool and it depends on how we use it. So let's look at the benign uses first. Let's think about technology as a tool in the office place. Where do you think you talk to a company called Delos, which is trying to create buildings that are healthier for people to work in. And you also, you know, did a lot with like temperature changes and researchers who were evaluating how productive people were. So let's talk about using this kind of technology as a tool to promote wellness. What are some of the interesting things that you discovered?
Yeah, well, so like one basic use is that technology and sensors are allowing a lot more detailed, fine-grained research that are really revealing lots of interesting insights about what we need to perform at our peak in offices. So part of it is just knowledge generation. Like, we can now do much more sophisticated experiments where we change the tint of a window or the glare of a window and monitor the light coming into an office and how that's affecting someone's heart rate, for instance. And so that's one interesting use. The other is that, as you were sort of getting at with Comfy, is it's giving employees a new ability in some cases to essentially create environments or sort of micro environments that meet their own needs. So if you are someone that's often cold, you can make your office area a little bit warmer. Another interesting corollary to that is they're also giving employees themselves more information about their environments. So I talk about one app that's been named Goldilocks, which essentially gives people feedback on the physical environment in their offices. So they can fire up this app and see, like, oh, this corner on the third floor right now looks like it's really dark and cool and quiet and no one's there, so I'm going to go work there. Whereas the lounge where I normally like to work looks like it's noisy right now and there are 10 people there, so maybe I'll avoid it today. So you're potentially empowering employees with information they can use to make choices about where they want to work and how they can sort of get the most out of their office spaces.
And you make a wonderful point that, okay, this might be good for white-collar workers, but this technology can be used in slightly more nefarious implementations. So I always think, I'm like, oh, if you're an Amazon warehouse worker, are they really going to care about optimizing your temperature for productivity? My hunch is no. So what's the flip side? What are the concerns about having these sorts of sensors in offices?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are plenty of them. And, you know, the sort of white collar distinction is an important one, because I think when we tend to see some of these apps that are designed to make workplaces more comfortable for people, I mean, they're almost exclusively for knowledge workers and office workers and not for maids or for roofers or for warehouse workers. You know, a productive worker is not necessarily the same thing as a happy and healthy worker. Obviously, there is some overlap, but I think it's easy for companies to try to optimize for raw productivity, like how many boxes a warehouse worker can pack in an hour versus balancing that with the worker's physical and mental health. And so we do see already a lot of sensors being used to monitor employees, like when warehouse workers take bathroom breaks, or a lot in trucking and delivery where they're used to monitor routes and even drivers' speeds. And so there's sort of this sense of surveillance and control that these technologies allow as well. And I should say that there's also some evidence that those kinds of uses can backfire, that workers often find ways to get around the surveillance or the tracking, and that they can also demoralize workers and impair their productivity.
This brings up our current era, which I know that you did the reporting on this book. It sounds like between kind of 2016, 2018, and this, obviously things have changed, not just in the tech world, but especially with COVID. And I feel like a lot of the technologies that you're talking about really could be beneficial here. And I am curious how you see some of these technologies being put into place, or what you think about what's happening with companies trying to do contact tracing in the office, that sort of thing. If you have words of wisdom for them.
I don't know about words of wisdom, but I mean, I think there are a couple of interesting dynamics at play. You know, I think one encouraging trend that I saw before COVID was that I think consumers and users of these sorts of technological systems and just the general public was becoming a bit more healthily skeptical of the power of technology companies and how our data is used and privacy and surveillance. And I think that was all to the good. One of my fears right now is that some of these sensor systems and technological systems, which are genuinely useful in this moment, you can think about, you know, like beacons. Some offices are adding beacons to their physical offices so they can track employees' locations, and so then they can alert people who have come, say, within 6 feet of someone who gets a positive test. I can totally understand why that's helpful right now, why that may be reassuring, and why employees might accept it. But I do worry about us becoming complacent about some of these use cases and applications and wonder if we're really going to be able to turn back the clock on some of these systems after the pandemic is over, if it's ever over.
Or if you think about things like in the smart home, like there are correlations between COVID-19 and heart rate variability. So as we discover more about that, if I, for example, am wearing something and my employer gets my heart rate variability and that's like, oh, she's at risk, you know, that has implications even if I'm not sick. And I feel like we don't have great safeguards in place around saying, oh, actually, I'm okay. This is just a medical condition, and maybe I don't really want to share that with my employer anyway.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have great safeguards, and even the safeguards we do have, and by we here, I actually more mean Europe, which, you know, is miles ahead of the U.S. in this. But even then, a lot of the safeguards are sort of designed to protect consumers. But things get a lot stickier when you start to think about an employer-employee relationship. And a lot of the laws and regulations that do exist don't really take into account the imbalance of power there and pressure that your boss can put on you to say, like, download this location tracking app or you're fired. You know, that's an entirely different dynamic beyond all the normal complications that go with smart products and technology.
That is a problem. And so you think legislation is the way we should look for a solution here?
I think legislation is part of it. I mean, I certainly think we need more regulation, and we need regulation with actual teeth, you know, that's enforceable and enforced, which doesn't always happen. But I think that's not the only part of the solution. You know, I think maybe I'm biased in favor of journalists here because I am one, but like, I think in recent years, journalists have been doing a much better job of being more skeptical of claims from tech companies and sort of covering some of these issues in a more critical way. And I think that's had a lot to do with some of the change in public attitudes, some of the new awareness of risk. And so I think public education and awareness around some of this stuff and the risks, which can often be really opaque, is an important component as well.
And then with that, let's talk about normal people. What do they need to know to navigate our sensor-laden future? I mean, part of me is like, you know, when I talk to my family about Ring doorbells, for example, and their contracts with police agencies, their eyes glaze over, and rightly so. It's not exciting for them to think about. So I guess, how do you have a conversation? How do you educate people about the risks and the potential that is possible when you have these sensors everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard question, and I don't know that I have good advice or answers on that. But I think one of the overwhelming factors for me that has kept me away from a lot of these systems and products is that this technology moves so fast that it's really hard to predict how systems you're installing today or products you're bringing home today or data you're willingly handing over today is going to be used in the future. And we've seen a number of cases where, you know, you might say, oh, I trust this small smart thermostat company with my data and, you know, they're family owned and I don't have any concerns, but then they get bought by a tech giant you don't trust, or data you give up on your heart rate. Suddenly in 5 or 10 years, we have algorithms that allow your insurance company to suddenly calculate your stroke risk. And so I think part of the danger is that future use cases change and they can be surprising. And so I don't know, that doesn't really answer your question, I guess, about how to talk about these things. But I think that is a risk that's worth bringing up with people if you're having conversations about whether to adopt some of these systems, is that not only do you need to do your homework on the product as it exists today, but you really need to spend time thinking about, well, what might happen 5 or 10 years down the line, and am I still comfortable with all the potential outcomes? So I think that's a worthwhile conversation to have.
Yes. And I'm toying with the idea of creating, we have a set of rules that we talk to people about at the IoT podcast when they buy connected products. And, you know, we tell them, hey, look for over-the-air updates, look for, you know, bug bounty programs, non-hard-coded passwords. But I'm starting to think that we should talk about things like data retention policies. So look for companies that let you delete your data every 6 months. Or that do it automatically, because I do think the future use of your data is something that most people aren't thinking about, and they probably should be, but it's also like we have enough to think about as normal people, so why would we think about it? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's also fair too, you know, like it's not, I hate to put the onus entirely on the consumer because really most of it shouldn't be, but that's part of why we need legislation and regulation is the more, you're right, we can automate that and put that on the company, the better off we'll be.
Thank you so much, Emily, for coming on the show. And as a reminder for everyone, you can buy The Great Indoors wherever books are sold.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week.